Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the technical net as we've done for 36 years, starting in September of 1982. The technical net is the gathering of the clan of curious radio amateurs. We meet every Sunday night, usually for 4 hours, in which they discuss their favorite subject. Wireless equipment, how to make it work better, how does it work, the 26 or 27 different kinds of ham radio, 2-meter FM repeater ham radio, which you're listening to now, is just one of them. The TechNet is broken up into, very roughly broken up into three sections. The first section, people sign in because they do have a question or a comment. We take them in order, and the various people signing in help answer those questions. No guarantee that there's 100% accuracy of the results, but when there's inaccuracy, that does get reported at a later time and get corrected. You could say that the material in the technical net is being peer-reviewed due to the fact that every bit of it is recorded and it's on a website. You can go to that website by Mike Perry, KC2NJI, which is called amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateurradio.tangovictor. You go there and you can find the last 11 years worth of technical net, thousands of hours worth. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play back what took place. And this net tonight, for instance, will be there within a couple of days. It'll be on a recording. Let me drop. So you could say all the tech nets do get reviewed and the errors do get corrected. Nobody has 100% accuracy, as you know. There is another website that, which is Mike number two, which is LimeRockTechNet.com, which also has supporting information, graphs and articles and whatever with reference to the technical net. So those two websites, LimeRockTechNet.com and AmateurRadio.TangoVictor, give you lots of information. This technical net won an award a few years ago for technical assistance, honored by the Board of Directors of Amateur Radio League, ARL. It may be a record holder for the longest standing technical net, 36 solid years, all under one leadership. So it may be an award for, it may be a record for number of years under one leadership and a total number of hours on the air, which is something like 6,000 hours, more hours on the air for the technical net than Johnny Carson was with the Tonight Show over his 30 years of history. Let me drop. So as I said, the first section is where people sign in because they do have a question or a comment, and we handle their questions and comments. The second section is where Roy, AC2GS, Dr. Roy, has material that's called the Science Talk. And he's got quite a number of interesting subjects tonight. The third section is run by Paul, WS2N, which is the Space Report. The Space Report should be quite interesting tonight because there is a launch by China called the Chang... Let's see now, it's called Chang'e 4. The Chang'e 4 spacecraft is going to land a rover and a stationary spacecraft on the back side of the moon. First time in history that's been done. Let me drop. In order to communicate with that spacecraft on the back side of the moon, another spacecraft has to be put into orbit at the moon-Earth Lagrange point, roughly 60,000 miles behind the moon, is a satellite that will be relaying the radio information from the backside of the moon up to the satellite and down to the Earth. So an ambitious project. And that's been reported, I think, in Newsday. Also, the December issue of IEEE Spectrum Magazine has at least a three-page article on the subject with pictures and explanations as to how it works. We'll be telling you how to get to that article by Googling IEEE Spectrum Magazine, the December issue. So quite possibly Paul will be telling you more information about that. Okay, I guess we're ready to get started with the TechNet. Let me drop it. If you do have a question or comment, you're going to give us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. You need that silence because you're listening. And for 36 years, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. When you do sign in, make sure you wait for the four beeps. We already have check-ins from Joe W to RYY and Doug W to SAY. Is there anyone else to check in to the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now after the beeps. K2RYW listening.
And to we have Dick, question and a comment.
Rich recognized. Anyone else? Okay, that signal was extremely weak. 10% audio, 80% noise. It sounded like WB2TTT. But as I said, I'm listening with earphones. If there's anything you can do to increase the signal strength, that was an extremely noisy signal. Give it another try with your name, sir. Over to you, K2RIW. WB2 Canada Quebec Tango Larry. And as I said, that time you were 20% audio, 80% noise. You're going to be a very difficult copy, but we'll give it a try. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
N2EO, Dick.
We've already got you signed in, Rich. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now after the beeps.
KC2SHO, John in Los Alamos.
John in Los Alamos. We got you, John. And good work is going on out there. I'll write that down. In fact, anything you can tell us about some of the great breakthroughs that are being made over the last whatever period of time, we'd like to hear from that also when it comes to your time, your term, John. One last call when I went on to check in, because you do have a question or comment for the net. Give me a call with his name right now after the beep, K2RIW. We have more than enough to get going, so Joe, W2RYY, how are those electrons and microwaves treating you today, and UHF waves, W2RYY, K2RIW, you got it, Joe.
It's treating me quite well. Now, here's a question about one of your other favorite subjects you like to talk about from time to time. And I guess it's like a winter subject. It's a question on oil burners. I mean, it interests everybody, but I know it interests you. Would you agree or disagree that using a carbon monoxide detector in the stack is a better way of adjusting the air-to-fuel ratio in such a burner? Back to you.
It couldn't hurt. Although carbon monoxide detectors, the ones that you and I can easily lay our hands on, are made for operating in ordinary room temperature air. If I took a conventional carbon monoxide detector and put it into the stack where the temperature might be, let me pick a number, 800 degrees Fahrenheit, would it behave correctly is an interesting question. I'm trying to think of the call letters of a ham on Long Island, former famous member of the Limock Group. Oh, can't think of his call letters right now. Who had a contract from Brookhaven Laboratories to measure the efficiency of oil burners on Long Island. I think he visited a significant number of homes, and he found out a high percentage of them, the oil-fuel-air mixture was being set very rich. In other words, low in air, high in oil, making a lot of soot. And why in the world oil burner servicemen set the mixture that way, non-stoichiometric mixture, is a real mystery to me. Oil burners have to be serviced every year to get rid of all that thick black soot that's in the flue pipes and whatever. All that thick black soot is due to improperly burned oil, insufficient oxygen. What I've done on multiple occasions is to lower the gallons per hour by choosing a smaller nozzle. I mean, if the original nozzle was 9/10 of a gallon, I go to 0.6 tenths of a gallon per hour, and make sure the air is sufficient so that you get a clean burning flame. When you get a clean burning flame, enough air in it, the flame is a little bit cooler. And at first that sounds like an inefficiency. Let me drop it. I'm convinced that in the big picture that is an increase in efficiency to have excess air. The excess air makes sure you get complete combustion, most likely a much lower level of CO2 when you do that, almost no soot when you get sufficient air. The soot that gets built up on your burner represents an insulating layer. So even though the flame may be the hottest at that particular fuel-air setting, and when you get a slightly rich amount of air and a slightly lean amount of fuel, you get a clean burning air that's a clean burning flame that's probably a little bit cooler. But the soot I get in my pipes, in my stack pipes, or what do you call it now, the exhaust pipe, is a brown-colored or tan-colored soot, not black. And my flue pipes need to be cleaned out once every 5 years, whether it needs it or not. Almost no soot there at all when you get a clean burning flame. And if there's any leakage in the system where any of the flue gases are getting into the house, I'd much rather have complete combustion to make sure there's no carbon monoxide being pumped into the house. So the majority of oil burners are being misset. They create a large, loud rumble. The fuel mixture is much too rich. The nozzle is too large. Many furnaces, when you try to give it sufficient air, with the nozzle that's there, you can't get enough air into the system. You have to go to a lower nozzle. Less gallons per hour means that the burner burns a slightly larger number of hours. And there's a slight disadvantage to that. If you get a super cold day of minus 10 degrees Fahrenheit, maybe your furnace running continuously will only bring your house up to 69 degrees Fahrenheit. That's a one-day per five-year event. Don't worry about it. So each time any of the people I talk to try to talk to their oil burner service people,
repeater, time out,
and recommend to them that they use a smaller nozzle, a quieter burn, a leaner fuel-air mixture, they get a whole lot of flack from that service person who says, I know my business, I know what I'm doing, don't talk to me. And a few of those people got so disenchanted, they flipped over the gas. So, an oil burner is not rocket science. We amateurs who know how to service radio equipment could be servicing our own oil burner and doing a much better job. And as I see it, there's a lot of room for improvement there. You shouldn't be hearing a rumble sound. You shouldn't be seeing black soot. The flue pipe shouldn't develop any black soot when you have sufficient fuel-air mixture. And just by looking at the flame and making enough air into the system with a small enough nozzle, visually you know when it's set right. And do you really have to measure the carbon monoxide? Do you have to buy a high-temperature measuring equipment for carbon monoxide? I'm not sure, but it couldn't hurt. And if you do follow through with that, Joe, tell us what you discover. W12YY, by the way, I've been servicing my own oil burner for 30 years. W12YY, K2IW in the TechNet.
There's a comment on that, Dick, and do we
Rich first. Go ahead, Rich. I mean, Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, Dick, everything you're saying is absolutely the truth. I took your advice when I lived in Whitestone. That's when I could walk downstairs and do the servicing. I put up the pressure on the nozzle. As you once said, I went to a smaller nozzle, a 0.5. It ran fine. I remember that fall when I cleaned the burner. All the soot pipe had was flue pipe had was white ash around the edges. No soot.
Hey, you brought up a very good point. That you get a white ash or a tan-colored ash when you get sufficient burning. A smaller nozzle is definitely the way to go. I also recommend one of these very fine oil filters, the white, very fine kind of oil filter. The oil filtering I do is cascaded. I've got two separate oil filters in line for the oil coming from my tank going into my burner. One is the normal felt type filter, I call that the coarse filter, followed in series with the fine white filter. If I used the fine white filter all by itself, it would clog up in a month. But by cascading them, the coarse felt filter only needs to be changed once per year, and that way the fine filter does a good job. When you're using 0.5 and 0.6 gallons per hour, you got to be doing fine filtering, in my opinion, otherwise you will get some nozzle clog periodically. Do change the nozzle once per year, because it's a wear-out device. No matter how well you do filtering, there's some fine grit in there that does create some wear. And if you download the instruction diagram, the instruction manual for nozzles, I can't think of the name of the company right now, that has this downloadable program, they show you a great advantage of resetting your 100 pounds per square inch by turning a screw in your burner pump from 100 up to 150 pounds per square inch. You get a much finer spray, a much more complete combustion. Also, for a small number of dollars, you can add a gauge to your burner. There's an opening there where the gauge can be put in permanently, and you can see the 150 pounds per square inch to know everything's working normally. You can also install on the fuel filter, the center bolt, a vacuum. Let me drop a vacuum gauge, so it will let you know when your filters are starting to clog. When the pump from your oil burner has to suck oil through the filters that are beginning to clog, the vacuum gauge you can put on the center bolt that's on the fine filter. When it starts reading a couple of pounds per square inch, a couple of inches of water, it's pounds per square inch, it goes up to 15. When you see, or is it 30? When you start seeing it come off the peg, you know you're starting to get clogging and it's time to change the filters. Changing the filters before that is a waste of time. Other than that, you don't know when to change the filters if you don't put in the vacuum gauge. So with these small changes, the vacuum gauge, the pressure gauge, 150 pounds per square inch, smaller nozzle, a richer amount of air, you do that all together, and you get a much quieter, cleaner burn, less gallons per oil per year, and a much safer system, in my opinion. And the oil service people, an awful lot of these things, they do not do. And you're buying a contract from them. And if you buy the oil on the open market, I think my last delivery was $2.42 a gallon. Whereas people with a contract are quite often paying $3.20 a gallon and paying $150 a year for the contract. And they're getting, in my opinion, poor servicing. Not a good picture. I did try to turn it over to Joe, so stand by there, Rich. Joe, W-R-Y-Y, do you have available to you a CO2 gauge that you believe will operate correctly at high temperatures? You've got it, Joe, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KD2HUC with a comment.
I can't answer that question because I don't know if the thing is rated for high temperatures or not. It's a portable type of detector. It detects a couple different gases, actually, but one it will detect is carbon monoxide, and that's what I was using. I'm running a 0.65 per gallon hour nozzle. My oil pressure is set for 150 psi, and I'm running two filters in line just like you are. But I thought also asking the question of the CO2 adjustment level, would that give me the best indication of the balance? Because it's hard. I don't know what the flame is supposed to actually look like. I know you've said this before, but it's hard comprehending what you think the flame is supposed to look like. Because one way, it completely fills up the firebox. If the center is one way, it seems to be that's the rich side. And if you pull it back the other way, the flame decreases dramatically and it gets very hot. With the air coming out of the viewing door where you can view the flame. That changes dramatically. And I'm not sure if that's the best way to adjust it either for temperature down there. But I thought by checking with a carbon monoxide detector It might, it's like tuning up a radio without test equipment. If you have a test equipment that can sense something, at least it, you know if you're going in the right direction. Back to you.
AC2GS with comments from Echo Link.
GS recognized and AQC recognized. AQC is going to go first, but first, Joe, my experience is that when you get sufficient air and a lean enough mixture, it is a hot flame, a small flame. The smaller, hotter flame, obviously, is the best. Most complete combustion. And if you really measure the temperature of the flame when you have a whole lot of air going in there, it is my guess the flame is small and a little bit cooler.
Repeater, time out.
But a lean fuel-air mixture, a slightly cooler flame, making less soot, is a hell of a lot better in my opinion. Your nozzle is trying to atomize the fuel, making very fine particles that burn completely. We all know that no matter what you do, you're going to get a Gaussian distribution of the size of those fuel particles that have been atomized. Most of them are small, but some of them will be a little larger. So that if you have just the right amount of air for the middle of that Gaussian curve, you may get the hottest flame. But all those particles that are a little bit larger on the right side of that distribution are going to be incompletely burned and make soot. If you make the fuel-air mixture a little bit leaner, a lot more air over to the right side of the Gaussian distribution, you burn up the larger particles, the larger atomized particles that are there. And that's the right way to go, in my opinion. Let's see what Steve has to say about all of the above. KD2HUC, K2LIW. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, Dick, a couple of things. One, I believe the two companies you were referring to were, one is Delvan and the other is Hago. And those are the two nozzle companies. Second thing is that while I agree with you, running a slightly lean flame, it certainly gives you the best burn. You have to be careful of running too lean for two reasons. Let me let it drop. One, you'll definitely notice that as you increase the amount of air into the firebox, the velocity through the heat exchanger increases, and you'll notice your stack temperature goes up, which of course means you're wasting money by sending extra heat up the chimney. Second, if the flame runs a little cool, like you say, which it will, if you run the flame a little too cool, you risk condensing flue gases on your exchanger. Oil combustion products are very corrosive. That's why they say you should never run a boiler below 140. And I forget what the rules are for hot air. I've never had a hot air furnace myself. But there are rules as far as making sure the heat exchanger doesn't run too cold where you start condensing flue gas materials on the exchanger because it will rot it out in a hurry. KD2, HEC, back to net.
Obviously, you can go too far with too much air. And if you did measure stack temperature versus air mixture, I think you're better off first viewing the flame and adjusting the amount of air for what you think is a small, hot, clean burning flame, where there isn't so much air that it almost blows out the flame, if you know what I mean. When it comes to the flue gases being a little bit hotter when you do that because it's moving through there faster, that sounds logical, but I doubt it, Steve. The reason for that is the total velocity of the gases going through the furnace versus the amount of air mixture. When you go from what I think is the right amount of air mixture to a little bit higher, maybe there's a 10% increase in velocity. Is that really a big difference in stack temperature? And if it's the stack temperature inefficiency that you're worried about, there's all kinds of heat exchangers you can put on that flue pipe. In my particular case, the furnace that I had to buy for my warm air house, I bought a replacement furnace. Let me drop this. The only one available to me that Durant, I think was the brand name. I'm not sure now. Not the brand name. It was a very highly recommended brand name at the time. The flue pipe came out the wrong side. So my flue pipe has got a great big double right angle bend before the pipe finally goes to the chimney. All of that pipe, in my case, is a heat exchanger running hot and taking the hot flue gases and giving me that heat inside the house. So there's all kinds of ways you can put fins on the flue pipe and recapture that those gas, the heat of those gases, in my opinion, and that's a small fraction of it. So that's a bunch of opinions on all of the above. One other thing that I'm doing that's highly non-recommended, I'm using a cascading of two filters. Let me drop this. As I had said, I've got a large felt-type filter. That's the coarse filter, followed in series by the fine white filter, microfilter, whatever that's called, with a the center bolt. You can buy a hollow bolt with a vacuum gauge on it, so you know when you're starting to get clogging of either filter because you start running vacuum. The output of those two cascading filters, in my case, goes to a T-connector. The T-connector feeds two oil-fired devices, my warm air furnace for the house, plus the hot water heater, which is also oil-fired. So one single pair of filters, one fuel line, is feeding two oil burners. You read any of the books, this is highly non-recommended. It gives me no problem. I've been running it that way for a whole lot of years, over 30 years, if you know what I mean. As long as I can see by way of the vacuum gauge whenever the filters are starting to clog and I know when to change them, even when both burners are running simultaneously, when the filters are clean, I see no vacuum registered on that gauge. So that non-recommended procedure works like a charm. I think Roy has some further information. By the way, as I said, everybody is afraid to touch their oil burner. Let me drop this. We amateurs, which are usually pretty crafty people, we know how to fix our own equipment. An awful lot of us have been taught that there's some kind of rocket science with an oil burner and we shouldn't touch it and it should be done by a professional. There's all kinds of books you can read on the subject. If you go to Sid Harvey, they will sell you some books that will give you some nice information. $10 or $20 is a book that will tell you an awful lot of information about maintaining your oil-fired furnace. Also, yes, do download the Delvon, D-E-L-V-A-N, I think it's a D-E-V-L-V-O-N. That company makes the nozzles. They've got a beautiful book that will give you a lot of information about nozzles and fuel air settings and pressure settings and so on. The price is right. As I said, do replace that nozzle once every year, just to be sure that it's a clean running nozzle. So, Roy, go ahead with your information. AC2GS. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick. I'm just echoing Steve. KA2YHY on EchoLink had a few text messages, and so I thought I would butt in and read them to you. He had three comments. The first one was adjust to zero smoke, comma lean. His second was higher pressure, and his third was talk about fuel conditioner, magic blue juice. And also he adds, okay on Beckett, but Riello is trouble. I don't know what that means.
KD2HUC with a comment on the Riello.
Yeah, Beckett, I think, is a very well-respected burner, and maybe the Riello is more troublesome. Is that what's going on here? Over to you, Steve from HUC. And by the way, Steve at YHY, I think he had some extra container of blue juice. This is a very expensive substance they sell at Steve Harvey, which when you pour a few ounces of it into your tank each time you're getting an oil fill, it does a beautiful job of dissolving the sludge in the bottom of the tank, which can therefore give you a clean flow. Let me drop. Sid Harvey also sells a very handy device. It's a CO2 blow gun. I think it's around $20. It's a device that you can add to the pipe coming from your oil tank into your burner. And by disconnecting that pipe and attaching this device and putting in a CO2 cartridge, you can discharge it and blow the oil back through that pipe into your tank. No matter what you do, even though when you use the blue substance to dissolve the sludge, periodically you will get a partial clog in that pipe coming out of the oil tank. I mean, even though you've got clean filters and you're starting to see vacuum, sometimes the pipe itself clogs. By blowing the oil back in there with the CO2 gun at high velocity, it cleans that condition out very simply, and that's something you've got to do maybe once every 2 years or so. So, as you can tell, very inexpensive devices, very easy to use devices, can easily maintain your oil-fired system, And when it comes to dollars per BTU, in other words, the amount of heating BTUs you get for your house versus the price of oil, I think when it's properly maintained, it is my belief you come out ahead with oil versus gas. But that's an opinion. But properly maintained oil can be clean, non-smelling, quiet, efficient, non-soot generating, non-CO2 generating, properly maintained. Oil can do a very good job, in my opinion. And when it comes to Steve, I think he did have an extra jar of the blue substance in his house, and I'm interested in talking to him about getting that extra jar. Now, Steve wanted to make some further comments. KD2HUC, K2RIW. Go ahead, Steve.
And so we owe the comment.
All right, me and Steve happened to...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And it does work wonders. He's certainly right about that. And he's also right about the Riello versus Beckett. You know, Beckett is a very simple, bare-bones burner. Parts readily available at Home Depot. Whereas the Riello, you're looking at a trip to Sid Harvey's, which is, of course, not as widely available to regular homeowners because, you know, when is a boiler break? 10 o'clock at night, Sid Harvey's isn't open. So unless you happen to have everything on the shelf and you know how to fix it. There are a lot of things I like, you know, complex, new technology, ham radio stuff. When it comes to heating my house, simple is better. KD2HUC, back to net.
The very first sentence or two, please repeat those, Steve, because you did time out and the machine had to be reset. So give us the first two sentences about Riello versus Beckett. Over to you, Steve.
Well, it's widely accepted that you can get higher efficiencies with the Riello machines over the Beckett's. But the Riellos are more complex. They have more specialized components, which are not as readily available as the Beckett's. The Beckett is a very plain, simple burner, parts readily available at Home Depot. So, you know, my particular opinion is when it comes to heating my house, simple is better, readily available parts are better. So I trade off the efficiency for that. KD2HUC, back to net.
Rich, please stand by. We know you're trying to give us another comment. What's different about the Riello? Is the difference in efficiency that much higher? And what makes it more elaborate, and what makes it lower in maintainability or reliability? So give us a few words on what the Riello looks like, Steve. Over to you, Steve, K2RIW. Steve, please pick it up.
All the Riello burners I ever worked on had almost like programmable logic controllers as opposed to simple oil primaries, you know, regular Honeywell primary controllers. And, you know, they're made by Riello, so you really can't do anything if that goes. You have to replace it in kind. A lot of the newer efficiency ones are modulating, which means they're not just on-off. They adjust the flame based upon the lows. And, you know, obviously modulating oil valves and modulating air dampers, they add a much, you know, higher level of complexity to the gun. You know, it's a trade-off. If you like toys, they're great, you know. They typically run, you know, very efficient, very clean. But when they break, you're not running out to Home Depot to get the parts, if you know what I mean. KD2HEC, back to net.
Yeah, KISS, keep it simple, stupid. So Beckett is nice and simple, straightforward. Not always. Why in the world would you want to adjust the fuel-air mixture as a function of load? Your furnace turns on until the house comes up to the right temperature. Why not run it at the ideal setting? Why change that? That's crazy. So, I mean, it may sound nice on paper, but I can't believe it's the right way to go. Another thing I want to mention is that when it comes to a oil-fired hot water heater, if the copper pipe supplying cold water into the heater and the hot water pipe coming back out, if those two pipes are isolated with insulating materials so that the tank itself does not have direct copper contact to the input and output pipes. When you isolate the tank in that manner, the galvanic action that you normally get inside that creates holes and creates water leakage it essentially disappears. I used to get pinholes in the pipes going across my basement and leakage because of those due to galvanic action. And the tank itself, the hot water tank, had to be replaced every few years. Now that I've isolated the tank so that it's a floating mechanism, the pinholes disappeared, and sacrificial rod inside, my sacrificial rod is 15 years old. I looked at it recently, and it's pristine like the day it was new. So why in the world people don't know to isolate the hot water tank to avoid all that galvanic action? The tank itself is made out of steel. The pipes are made out of copper. That dissimilar metal combination with a small amount of ionic material you've got in your water supply makes galvanic action take place that eats...
Repeater, timeout.
That eats away the tank and you eventually get leakage, even though it's glass-lined. No matter how carefully they glass-line it, somewhere there's a leakage going to start. And so by isolating, that problem goes away. I'm amazed that that's not also being done. But yeah, I forget who's supposed to... Oh, yes. Rich wanted to make a further comment. N2EO, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, take N2EO. I almost forgot what I was going to say, but there's a company from Italy. I don't know the name of it. That's what I want to find out. They make a very high efficient oil burner. One time when I was in a hospital, many of my many visits, Patty told me she had the oil company put in one of these burners. It's made in Italy, and they said it's the most efficient burner of all. What do you believe, and what's the name of the company?
Now, this I haven't heard about. But if you're using a smaller-than-normal gallons-per-hour nozzle of the right flare angle, solid or hollow, the one that's recommended by your particular burner, and the right amount of air, you get such a complete combustion of the fuel that you're not making any soot anymore, and how you can get much higher efficiency than that, I'm amazed. The only thing left to get efficiency out of this system would be the hot flue gases, and if you have the right kind of heat exchanger, fins or whatever, on your flue pipe, or a longer flue pipe because you've meandered it around the basement in some manner, I think you can get all the efficiency you want. I think I'm burning something like 600 gallons per year to heat my house, and I keep my house at 74 degrees Fahrenheit when it's running efficiently. If this very elaborate system made by the Italian company, or if the Rialto system gives me 5% more efficiency, that could be a false economy if I'm getting lower reliability. And just keep it simple, in my opinion, is the right way to go. And with any further comments on oil burners and their maintenance by us, give me your call letters right now, K2IW and the TechNet.
WB2GXM with a question.
Mr. WB2GXM, I should know you. Start off with your name and your question, sir. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Dick. K2RW in the group. This is Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf X-Ray. My name is Rich. Dick, I have a question. You were talking about galvanic action in oil burners when the pipes are right on top of the burner. I have gas in my house, for one thing. I don't know if that makes a difference to the galvanic action, but is that when the pipes are actually touching, when the copper is actually touching the steel of the burner? Does that make sense? It occurs to me that these pipes are actually physically separate from the burner body. Correct me if I'm wrong on this, WB2GXM.
Some oilers are made out of iron, steel, whatever, and the pipe is directly coupled to the copper pipes that go to your baseboard radiators. Whenever steel and copper come in contact with each other, with a fluid in between flowing there like water, you're going to get galvanic action. The galvanic action is going to create erosion of both the steel and the copper. So in my opinion, putting isolating devices, which you can buy from a good plumbing supply house, so that there's a ceramic insulating device so that the copper and steel do not come in direct contact with each other, drastically increases the life of both of those systems, in my opinion. The first thing you're going to ask is, hey, the grounding of the oil burner itself, which is making direct contact to the furnace, is going to negate this. Well, there's ways you can put rubber washers in there so the mounting of the oil burner is, again, isolated. And the oil burner itself is, in many cases, being grounded by the BX cable. And the BX cable has got a hell of a lot more resistance. It's got milliohms of resistance, where the copper pipe that used to be there has got microohms, and you get a hell of a lot more galvanic action. So isolating steel from copper has a huge advantage, in my opinion. Now, maybe you got to be a little bit careful about the proper grounding and safety of your features, but galvanic action of steel in direct contact with copper is, in my opinion, very undesirable. Do you see what I'm saying on this one, Rich? WB2GXM, K2RIW.
Yes, I do, and actually, I understand now that we're actually talking about the pipe that is the pipes that are entering and exiting the burner. Which I would probably have to hire a plumber to do some of this stuff, which is a cheerful thought. WB2GXM.
KD2HUC with a comment.
Steve recognized. To open up a pipe, cut it back a little bit, and put an insulating device in there, guarantee you can handle that, Rich. That's not very complicated. Go right ahead, Steve. HUC, K2RIW.
Well, I just wanted to point out for Rich that the majority of new water heaters, you know, new being within the past, you know, 10 years or so, especially gas ones, already come equipped with dielectric unions as part of the tank assembly. So he may not have to modify it. It might already exist. But don't forget, when you isolate the tank and you put this electrical separation between the hot and cold, make sure you bond around it, because otherwise your hot water system is not properly bonded. KD2HUC, back to net.
Yeah, glad you mentioned that, Steve. By way of the cold water pipe that goes to your faucet and the way the faucet is grounded, I think you have inadvertently your hot water pipe also being grounded. But to be double down sure, I would put a grounding wire between the input pipe and the output pipe of the hot water heater system so that the copper is made continuous independent of the tank itself. That's a belt and suspenders. I think the system is still, even though your hot water pipe looks like it's floating, by way of the hot water pipe touching the faucet of the sink in the bathroom and the sink in the kitchen, and the way those pipes are connected, I think you're left-handedly getting grounding. What do you think on that one, Rich? KD2HUC, K2RIW in the tech van.
Well, it depends. If you use copper leaders from the shut-off valves up to the faucet, I agree with you 100%. But 9 times out of 10, people are lazy. They don't want to deal with bending copper, and they use those flexible hoses that run from the shutoffs up to the faucet. So there is no real electrical connection unless you happen to spend the extra dollars for the stainless steel berets, which most people don't do. But there is a kit Home Depot offers just to bond around the hot water heater. It's about $10. So you can't go wrong with it. It comes with two pipe clamps and I think a number 4 conductor, about 3 feet to go between. You can't go wrong. About 3 seconds with a screwdriver. KD2HUC, back to net.
That's very good to know, Steve. Thank you. Also, give me some more words. Are you telling me that the latest hot water heaters you can buy come with insulated unions on them, that somebody finally has caught on to this problem after all these years? That's brand new to me. So I think you're saying that the better brand of hot water heater tanks you buy these days are already insulated to get rid of this galvanic action. If you look at the so-called dielectric, what is it called, an electromotive series or something like that. In other words, there's a list of materials, copper, zinc, steel, and whatever, zinc, as to which materials can come in direct contact with each other before you get galvanic action. And copper and steel are really no-nos. So for years we've had a steel tank glass lined. We thought that was going to protect it with copper pipes going into it. And the diameter of that copper water pipe is such that you're getting micro ohms of resistance. You're getting beautiful grounding and therefore galvanic action. So for how long, and do you think almost all the brands of hot water heaters you buy these days have these insulated unions? KD2HUC, K2RIW, glad to hear this news. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, Dick, I've installed three water heaters over the past 10 years. I know one was GE, one was Dream. I don't remember what the third one was, but it wasn't one of those two. But all three of them had, you could see the ceramic inserts where the union's attached at the top, and, you know, to isolate the tank. So, yeah, I guess they finally did catch on to it. So, it's good news. KD2HUC, back to net.
When you're installing one of these insulated new hot water heater tanks, when it comes to the gas-fired or oil-fired heater for it, do the instructions come with procedures and recommendations to try to isolate the burner itself? Although the burner is nowhere near as well grounded in the micro-ohm category, and maybe it's not a problem, but do the instructions give you any information about how to isolate the burner itself? KD2HUC, K2RIW.
Well, for the gas ones, that's a good question. All the ones that I've installed didn't require electric, so they were inherently just floating. But you bring up a good point. Let me let it drop. As far as the oil ones, unless you happen to get, you know, a little complicated and maybe add a remote relay and use a 24-volt aquastat, most of them, they all come with line voltage aquastats, and by NEC requirements, you have to ground the aquastat. So when essentially you're grounding the tank, whether you float the burner or not. So with that, you know, I don't know that there's any real way that you can float the tank from, you know, from ground of the electrical system. KD2HUC, back to net.
Yeah, the aquastat itself, the thing that measures the temperature of the water, it is inherently grounded. But it's grounded by way of, let me pick a number, 14-gauge wire. So it's got milli-ohms of grounding as opposed to the micro-ohms of grounding you get from the copper pipe. As such, that might be a red herring. Is there a way of floating that system and still making it work correctly is one question. And the burner itself, the black pipe that brings your gas into a gas burner, or the electrical wiring, 110-volt wiring with the PX cable that brings power into your oil burner that's firing the hot water heater, that, if it's screwed down to the tank, is going to create grounding. In my case, I put some rubber washers there to float it, to float the actual burner from the tank. I'm asking, to your knowledge, do the instructions coming with this isolated tank give you any recommendations on how to float either aquastat or the burner itself? KD2HUC, K2RIW.
Not that I've seen. And also, you got to keep in mind, Dick, the use of BX is, you know, a thing of the past. Now, for the majority installations, either hard pipe EMT or MC cable, which has a grounding and bonding conductor, an equipment grounding conductor that's of equal size to the ungrounded conductor. So, floating it, I mean, unless you find some way of isolating it from the well, but then again, the probe is all copper, and that goes into the well regardless whether or not the aquastat is actually clamped to the well. I don't know. I don't know of any easy way to do it, and I don't recall ever seeing anything in the instructions, providing direction. So, I'll have to say I don't know. KD2HUC, back to net.
Yeah, floating the burner and the controls to the aquastat, that's something further to be isolated, to be investigated as I see it. I didn't do anything to float my aquastat, but my galvanic action essentially disappeared. So just floating the copper pipes, I think, is 95% of the solution from what I observe. Okay, we're going to go on to the next person, Doug, W-A-2-S-A-Y, who Doug, I am watching channel 2-1, which is CBS, and 2-2, which I believe is on a different frequency, and it's a different programming. It's non-CBS, and I think it's coming from a different direction. And maybe Eric will give us information on that. But first, I think this is going to be one of your questions, Doug. W-A-2-S-A-Y, glad to hear you these days. K-2-L-I-W in the DuckNet.
W-A-2-S-A-Y here. Yeah, that was the question. What are these channels? Where are they? What frequency are they? What kind of a TV set do you have to have to receive them? I'm sure I wouldn't get them out here in Rocky Point because I'm, 60 miles from Manhattan, so I'm absolutely sure I wouldn't get them over the air, but I'm just curious. Before we go into that, I just want to make one comment about the furnace system. A couple of years ago, my server people said that it would be a good idea if the furnace and the water heater flu systems do not work at the same time. So they came and put some kind of a relay system in so that when the water heater heats and there's flu gases coming out of it, the furnace is off. Oops, I'm running out of gas here.
It sounds like you're running into a dead battery. Maybe you're going to be able to hear us, even though you can't transmit. If your fuel flu pipe is large enough in diameter, which I think is around 9 inches, I see no problem if running the furnace, oil-fired furnace, and oil-fired hot water heater simultaneously. My system does. I often watch the amount of vacuum on my cascaded filter system when both are running at the same time. And the extra heat of the flue pipe and chimney when the hot water heater is running and when the furnace is running gives me a little bit greater vacuum up the chimney, and the whole system runs very well. So if your flue pipe is large enough in diameter, I don't see why you need a restriction on running them simultaneously. I do, and have been doing it for 30 years. So B2SAY, if you still have some battery power, K2RIW, go ahead, Doug.
Great shot. It was that way when I bought the house, and it was that way for several years, but then they decided I should have it changed. Anyway, what's the question about the channel 2.1 and 2.2?
Yeah, let's see if anybody knows. 2-1 is CBS coming from New York City, from, I guess, Empire State Building or World Trade Center. 2-2... I'm not sure what it's coming from and whether or not it's on a different frequency. So if anybody can tell us where 2-2 over-the-air broadcast is coming from, frequency-wise, call letters, and it is different programming. I'm watching over-the-air television with a simple antenna on the roof of the house, but I'm on 300 foot above sea level land. Simple antenna on the house, and I watch 2-1 and 2-2 with no problem. So 2-2, anybody can give us any information about it, please do so right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
CBS New York.
Okay, CBS New York is 2-1. Joe, are you saying 2-2 is also CBS New York, the exact same frequency? Over to you, Joe.
You mean like 584 to 590 megahertz? Yes, I am saying that.
So I think you're saying if a person is watching over-the-air broadcast television and he's getting 2-1, with the exact same signal-to-noise ratio, he should be getting 2-2, is what I think you're saying, Joe. I'll wait for the beeps and go right ahead, Joe.
That's correct.
Hey, Dick.
Doug, I don't think you're watching over-the-air broadcast. I think you've got a cable system, and maybe there's a disconnect between you and your cable system as far as 2-2 is concerned. To B2SAY with some wait for the beeps, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Got the beeps. As far as I know, all I get is a regular channel 2 over the cable. Yes, it's cable out here, obviously. It's not over the air. I never heard of 2-1 or 2-2, and I wouldn't know what kind of a TV set you'd have to tune it.
Well, every television set you buy these days, by FCC mandate, has over-the-air broadcast capability. Therefore, it can tune to all of those channels, 2 through 15. check with Joe on that. WHYY for update and correction. KTRIW in the TechNet.
Eric, you probably would be a better one to ask that, but I believe you're absolutely right. After a certain time, 2009, 2010, when they went digital, I think before then, plenty of manufacturers were getting set up to be able to make the TV tuners receive a digital format as far as reception goes, as well as the analog format that's used to receive for the last 30 or 40 years. I think they're making TVs for a good couple of years before that, probably around 2002, 2003, 2004, they started having digital tuners built into them also, because they were operating on some UHF frequencies. I don't know if they were digital, but they're operating at least on the Orgarias, some other frequencies. Some of these channel heads like split, they were like VHF and UHF at the same time. But I think the UHF, the tuners were being made available before the FCC actually mandated in 2009 and everything went digital.
So what year is your TV set, Doug? Any reasonably modern TV set by FCC mandate has built-in circuitry capable of receiving over-the-air digital and analog television. When I scan for the channels, for instance, all of my digital channels are there over-the-air, as well as analog channel 17 over-the-air. Comes through my set that was bought 5 or so years ago. The B2SAY, wait for the beeps, K2LIW in the TechNet.
B2SAY. Well, I'm sure I'm not going to get anything over the air because I'm only about 160 feet above sea level, and there's all kinds of hills and stuff between me and the city. And I don't have an antenna on the roof anyway. It's all cable. And the TV set that I have was bought last, roughly a year ago. It's as modern as you probably are going to get. So I'm just curious, you know, I don't care if I get these channels or not. I'm curious what the heck they are. And I guess they're all UHF now. USAY back to net. Thank you for the help. See you guys.
Very fine, Doug. You're so far north in Rocky Point that you probably have an over-the-water pass to Empire and World Trade. On top of that, where you're located, there's a good number of channels coming from New England. And even if you had direct line of sight to New York City, I strongly recommend anyone doing over-the-air digital broadcast television reception do install a rotator on your antenna. Because tilting the antenna back and forth just a few degrees will, in many cases, take a multi-pass situation where you're getting inter-symbol distortion and drop out of digital television, and it'll come back in. So with a rotator on an antenna on the roof of your house, I give you a 50-50 chance. Most of the year, you're going to see a number of the strong New York City stations. I know you're going to get a number of New England stations directly over the air broadcast. And some of those channels are not necessarily covered on your cable system. So if you have the enthusiasm to put an antenna with rotator on your roof, it doesn't even have to be very high above your roof, and you do over-the-air television broadcast reception, I think there's a 80% chance you're going to be very pleasantly surprised on what you're going to receive, particularly from New England, Doug. W2SAY, wait for the beeps. K2RIW in the TechNet.
If I ever get anything on the roof, it's going to be 6 meters, 2 meters. But anyway, I don't watch that much TV. I watch the news and I watch Jimmy Fallon. That's about it, really. And something on Friday nights on Channel 2 at 10. The Blue Suits or whatever they call it, I watch that. That's about the limit. Anyway, thanks for the information, and I'll say goodnight now and listen out. WA2SAY will be clear. Goodnight, everybody.
Goodnight, Doug. I'm glad to hear you. I think it's called, not Blue Suits, Blue Bloods, I think is the name of the police-like program. Okay. Rich was the next person on our list. N2EO. Go right ahead, Rich. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, and to be first.